which North-South relations are developing is so quick, and Seoul seems determined to keep up that pace. And that, of course, has created some level of concern in Washington.
The United States and South Korea move in different directions when it comes to North Korea. This is Thursday, August 16th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You're part of the program. Also ahead, continuing violence in Afghanistan, and the U.S. defense chief warned South America about China. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Stay with us. We start today's program with North Korea. The U.S. Wednesday sanctioned companies in China, Russia, and Singapore, it says, were violating the trade embargo with North Korea, Washington's latest effort to keep pressure on Pyongyang to end its nuclear weapons development. The U.S. Treasury is accusing a Chinese company, along with its Singapore-based affiliate, of falsifying documents to ease illicit shipments of alcohol and cigarettes into North Korea that netted the companies more than $1 billion a year. The U.S. also said that a Russian company violated U.N. sanctions by providing port services to already sanctioned North Korean flagged ships involved in oil shipments at three eastern Russia ports. The company's director general was also blacklisted. Sanctions freeze any assets they may have in the U.S. and blocks Americans from doing businesses with them. In announcing the sanctions, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said, Treasury will continue to implement existing sanctions on North Korea and will take action to block and designate companies, ports, and vessels that facilitate illicit shipments and provide revenue streams to North Korea. Consequences for violating these sanctions will remain in place until we have achieved the final, fully verified denuclearization of North Korea. Now, that move came on the same day South Korean President Moon Jae-in said his government plans to begin a joint railway project with North Korea this year, while also linking full-scale inter-Korean economic cooperation with denuclearization progress in the North. Moon and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un agreed to pursue increased economic cooperation when they met in April. Is there a division between the U.S. and South Korea when it comes to dealings with Pyongyang? We welcome once again to VOA Asia, Evans Rabir. He is senior advisor with the Albright-Stonebridge Group, and from 2007 to 2012, he served as president and CEO of the Korea Society. Evans, thanks once again for being with us. Are these two countries moving apart in their approach to North Korea, South Korea, and the United States?
I think it's pretty clear that the relationship between Seoul and Washington when it comes to sinking their North Korea approaches and their policies, it's becoming more complex, a lot more complicated, and a lot more difficult to manage, mainly because the pace at which North-South relations are developing is so quick, and Seoul seems determined to keep up that pace. And that, of course, has created some level of concern in Washington about the pace and scope and content of what Seoul is doing with North Korea. The other problem, of course, is that despite the support that Seoul has expressed for North Korea's complete and final denuclearization, it has not made that issue of denuclearization as high a priority as it should, and certainly not as high a priority as the United States has made it.
Do you think that the United States always had a position that denuclearization of the North had to come first?
That's always been the U.S. position, and it's become even clearer in recent months that the United States wants denuclearization to happen quickly, early, before any significant benefits flow to North Korea, and certainly before there's any serious discussion of a peace treaty or a peace declaration. The notion of the parties concluding a peace treaty with North Korea while North Korea remains a nuclear-armed country is just not on. And that's not something that I fear Seoul fully appreciates and understands.
So where does the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, go from here? Do you think he's moving forward, or do you think he is going to be hampered somewhat by the U.S. stand?
I think he's eager to move forward. Reading the speech that he delivered on the anniversary of South Korea's liberation, the speech that he delivered yesterday, it's pretty clear that he is determined to move quickly with the North. He made an allusion to taking, I believe the word was, audacious steps towards a peace declaration and a peace treaty. I'm not sure what that means, but the word audacious coming in that context is one that probably set several people's teeth on edge in Washington when he said it.
Where do other Asian nations stand? We know that Japan has taken a very hard stand against Pyongyang's nuclear capabilities, and where does China stand?
Well, the Chinese have been rapidly refurbishing and repairing their relationship with Pyongyang. We've had visits by the North Korean leader to Beijing, visits that probably involved some coordination of policy and approaches. We've had a major effort on the part of both the Chinese and the North Koreans to restore as much of the old close relationship as possible between Beijing and Pyongyang. We have the Chinese looking the other way occasionally in terms of sanctions implementation, allowing goods and services to be exchanged between the two economies. And that's obviously problematic, but it's also perhaps an indication of the direction that China wants to go in providing some level of aid and sustenance for North Korea. It's also, I think, an ominous signal that the maximum pressure campaign, to the extent that it is an international campaign, has fallen on some difficult times right now. We have indications of Chinese and Russian efforts to get around international sanctions. You stated at the top of the program a number of companies and entities that have been sanctioned that were in violation of international sanctions. We also, interestingly enough, had the South Koreans in violation of international sanctions by receiving shipments of North Korean coal, a number of shipments that came into South Korea. So I think it's a very timely step that the Treasury Department has taken to reinforce the sanctions regime and to put sanctions on new individuals and new entities, because there is a concern among the expert community that the overall maximum pressure campaign, or at least the sanctions aspect of it, is beginning to erode, perhaps rather quickly.
Evans Revere is senior advisor with the Albright Stonebridge Group and the former president and CEO of the Korea Society. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Japan's Emperor Akihito expresses his deep regret for his country's actions during World War II. South Korean President Moon Jae-in says he and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will take a bold step in their upcoming summit to formally ending the six-decade-old war that split the two sides. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi says his country will launch its first manned space mission by 2022. And officials say Cambodia's ruling party won all seats in July voting. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. Following days of relentless attacks and fierce fighting in various parts of the country, a suicide attack Wednesday on an educational institution in Kabul killed almost 50 people, thus testing Afghan security forces. The blast in Mowood Academy in a Shiite-dominated part of town happened when students were taking a university entrance examination. Afghan Taliban have denied responsibility. Previous attacks on Shiites in Kabul have been claimed by Islamic State. We'll have more on what's been happening in Afghanistan coming up. Happening now in Asia, the death toll from the worst floods in nearly a century in the Indian tourist state of Kerala rose to 43 Wednesday as rising water stranded tens of thousands of people and forced the closure of one of its main airports. The University of North Florida in the United States is the latest to cut ties with China's Confucius Institute. And New Zealand has banned most foreigners from buying homes as it tries to tackle runaway housing prices. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. Thanks so much for being with us. Dozens of casualties are reported following a Taliban attack on a military outpost in northern Baghlan province Wednesday. That followed a Tuesday attack in which insurgents overran a remote military base in northern Faryab province that killed 17 security force members with dozens wounded and injured. Tuesday, the Taliban withdrew from the central city of Ghazni after 5 days of bitter fighting with Afghan forces backed by U.S. military advisors and airstrikes. Hundreds of casualties are reported. Residents Wednesday emerged from their homes to find many dwellings burned. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke about what was going on with the Indiana University professor Nazif Shirani, who was in Kabul, and said the insurgents made use of the last Eid truce in June.
They took advantage of the last 3 days of ceasefire, infiltrated cities like Ghazni and many other places. After their ceasefire, they have intensified the war with huge destruction. So the chances are they will. I hope that the government would not, because it would not be to advantage of the population who are suffering from their intensified war after their ceasefire.
I understand that the Taliban is being pressured by friendly forces like Muslim nations to engage in another truce like they did in June.
But those temporary truces are actually no truce. They are preparation for more war. And unfortunately, these things sound a lot better outside than inside Afghanistan, especially people who are being killed, their houses burned and destroyed.
Nazif, the Taliban insists that it has spoken recently with the top American official on Afghanistan and Pakistan in Qatar. What do you know about this?
I think the reports here in Kabul are also the same, that they have been meeting with Americans. But the idea is that they're meeting and talking, but not negotiating, whatever that means.
What can you tell me about the fighting for Ghazni, in which hundreds, perhaps, may have been killed?
There is no doubt. The statistics that I heard yesterday, the number of kills are well over 200. And the injuries and property damage is incredibly large. I just heard the news that they have routed the Taliban outside the city today. So life is beginning back to sort of normalcy. They have essentially burned the city down while they were in the city fighting.
At the same time, the Taliban overran a remote military base in northern Faryab province. What about that?
The people in Faryab are also extremely disturbed. The government is not supporting their resistance, and they're not providing sufficient material for the forces there to fight. They have been under siege. And that's, again, the same story, that there are people within the government who are actually encouraging, probably, Taliban takeover, especially of areas in the north. There have been areas fallen under their hands.
Nazif Shirani said security in the country is deteriorating by the minute. You're listening to VOA News. This news alert from VOA Asia: the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says a food shortage in North Korea could have potentially catastrophic effects. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi vowed in his Independence Day speech to make the country an engine for global economic growth. A panel appointed by the Myanmar government to probe alleged human rights abuses against that country's ethnic Rohingya minority meets for the first time. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis is cautioning South American nations about Chinese aggression. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with Secretary Mattis in the region. Speaking from Buenos Aires, Argentina, she tells International Edition Sarah Williams about Mattis' comments.
Secretary Mattis is trying to tell all of the nations he's visiting in South America that the United States wants to remain the partner of choice when going with military relationships. But while he was speaking to a group of military students yesterday in Rio, the secretary was cautioning against Chinese aggression in the region.
I believe Secretary Mattis's comments on the South China Sea got quite a bit of attention. What did he say about that?
Secretary Mattis basically said that because of China's actions in the South China Sea, it is shredding the trust of the nations in the area by the militarization. He was asked about an exercise called RIMPAC. It's the Rim of the Pacific exercises. And China was disinvited to these exercises this year after they acted contrary to what their president had publicly promised. Mattis said that after thinking about this, he saw that China moved weapons into the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea after saying they would not do so. And after that, he goes, there's no need for militarization of those islands. China broke their word, and therefore they do not need to be in these exercises where we're promoting freedom of navigation.
How much of an overture has China made to these countries in South America?
Well, Chinese influence is primarily commercial here, but experts have been telling me that there are reasons why the Chinese have been wanting to make inroads in the military atmosphere as well. Basically, it all goes back to economics. They want to make these military inroads so they can protect and secure their products. But Secretary Mattis has cautioned against these partnerships, saying that respect for each other comes first and look at the deals that they're making elsewhere. He pointed to a deal that China had made with Sri Lanka, where the Chinese gave the Sri Lankans great loans they could not pay off. And so the Chinese ended up taking their port. Sri Lanka handed over the port to Beijing for 99 years after Sri Lanka could not make its payments. So he said, respect for each other comes first. Let's make sure democracies, which is another cut at China, let's make sure democracies stay on top. Don't allow China to use predatory economics and pile massive debt on anybody in this hemisphere.
That was VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams from Buenos Aires. This news alert from VOA Asia. Oil demand in Asia's key oil importers and fastest growing markets, China and India, has been growing at a slower pace this year than before. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said on Wednesday his country will provide health insurance to 100 million families to help them access good quality and affordable health care. All the big stories come your way through the day at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. The world will soon have its first batch of commercially available 3D printed concrete homes. A consortium of the Dutch municipality of Eindhoven, Eindhoven University of Technology, and three private firms has joined forces to build five of these unique homes in the hub city of Eindhoven in the Netherlands. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
You could be looking at the face of the future. They're just an idea right now, but these conceptual images show what could be coming soon to a neighborhood near you. The world's first commercial 3D printed concrete homes.
We start with a digital 3D model on your computer. This model then gets sent to the 3D printer, and it will print it from bottom to top, layer by layer, without any temporary supports or formwork until the object is complete.
Structural research engineer Rob Wolfs so the technique is more environmentally friendly than traditional concrete construction methods because almost all waste is eliminated, cutting CO2 emissions from cement production.
We place material only where we need it, layer by layer, thereby not realizing massive solid structures, but really thin, hollow objects that only have the concrete structurally where we need it and no concrete where we don't need it. So overall, the building will use much less material and therefore be much more sustainable.
Wolfs says 3D printing concrete allows irregular shapes to be designed, which could make it a potential game changer for the construction industry.
So objects that architects design that cannot be manufactured with traditional techniques are now suddenly possible. On the other hand, this also brings the construction industry closer to the end user because they can join in on the design process and customize objects instead of making houses and buildings that are all the same.
The engineering team is planning to print the first house, a single floor dwelling, next year and apply what they learn to future homes, all of which will be completely printed and constructed in the Meerhoven district of Eindhoven over the next 5 years. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
One of the oldest zoos in the United States, the Lincoln Park Zoo, is celebrating a big milestone, its 150th anniversary. It opened in 1868 with just two pair of swans. The zoo has a considerably larger collection today, but its priorities haven't changed all that much. As Roman Verhofsky reports, the zoo remains focused on conservation, preserving rare species, organizing educational programs, and setting an example for future generations of animal lovers.
The history of Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo started 150 years ago with a gracious gift from New York City officials.
When the commissioners of the Board of Public Works of the City of Chicago received a gift of two pairs of swans from the commissioners of Central Park in New York City. The gift was actually arranged by two brothers, a man named Andrew Green, who is quite famous for starting a lot of the famous cultural institutions in New York City, and his brother, who was working for the Illinois-Michigan Canal.
The swans appear to have brought the zoo good luck. Today, their descendants still float gracefully in the zoo's pond, but there's a lot more to see. Spread across 5 square kilometers, the Lincoln Park Zoo boasts a spacious pool for sea lions, big pavilions for predators, and giant spaces for herbivores. With more than 200 different species of animals on display, it's a popular attraction that draws about 3 million visitors each year.
Hi, yeah, I do visit the zoo often. We live in Chicago, and I wasn't aware that it was the anniversary, so that's fantastic.
But with the Earth's climate changing and the loss of natural habitats, many of the animal species on display are fighting for their survival.
This species of penguins, African penguins, are endangered in the wild, and we're part of a species survival plan, working with other zoos to support the population. And so that's really good news here. When we had that chick born, he's about 4 months now, and he's already almost as big as his parents.
A lot of people believe penguins only live in the icy Antarctic, but these little ones come from South Africa. Chicago's climate is very similar to where they come from, so the birds feel right at home with the windy city's snowy winters and warm summers.
But I think this is one of the best enclosures for penguins I've seen yet.
So the zoo has always been free since it was started as a civic park. The question came up early in the zoo's history, sometime in the 1870s, of whether we should start charging for some buildings to sort of maintain and pay for the animals' upkeep. The commissioners in the 1870s decided no, it would always remain free.
A lot has changed at Lincoln Park Zoo over the last century and a half, but some things remain the same. For visitors and animal researchers, it's a place to appreciate nature and cherish the wildlife that live among us. For Roman Verhofsky in Chicago, I'm Anna Rice, VOA News.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let us hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook, as well as our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thank you to the listeners at DZUP at 1602 AM Radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman in Quezon City, Philippines, and Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.